1751, BBC News.
And now on BBC Radio 4, we travel to Grasmere in the Lake District and the home of William Wordsworth, where Sir Ian McKellen reads from The Prelude, Wordsworth's autobiography in verse.
The leaves were yellow when to Furness Fells, the haunt of shepherds, and to cottage life I bade adieu. And one among the flock who by that season are convened like birds trooping together at the fowler's lure, went back to Granter's cloisters. Not so fond or eager, though as gay and undepressed in spirit as when I thence had taken flight a few short months before, I turned my face without repining from the mountain pomp of autumn, and its beauty entered in with calmer lakes and louder streams. And you, frank-hearted maids of rocky Cumberland, you and your not unwelcome days of mirth, I quitted, and your nights of revelry, and in my own unlovely self sat down in lightsome mood. Such privilege has youth that cannot take long leave of pleasant thoughts. We need not linger o'er the ensuing time, but let me add at once that now the bonds of indolent and vague society relaxing in their hold, I lived henceforth more to myself, read more, reflected more, felt more, and settled daily into habits more promising. Two winters may be passed without a separate notice. Many books were read in process of this time, devoured, tasted, or skimmed, or studiously perused, yet with no settled plan. I was detached internally from academic cares, from every hope of prowess and reward, and wished to be a lodger in that house of letters, and no more. And should have been in such, but for some personal concerns that hung about me in my own despite perpetually, no heavy weight, but still a baffling and a hindrance, a control which made the thought of planning for myself a course of independent study seem an act of disobedience towards them who loved me, proud rebellion and unkind. This bastard virtue, rather let it have a name it more deserves, this cowardice, gave treacherous sanction to that overlove of freedom planted in me from the very first, and indolence by force of which I turned from regulations even of my own as from restraints and bonds. The employments of three winters when I wore a student's gown have been already told, or shadowed forth as far as there is need. When the third summer brought its liberty, a fellow student and myself, he too a mountaineer, together sallied forth, and staff in hand, on foot pursued our way towards the distant Alps. An open slight of college cares and study was the scheme, nor entertained without concern for those to whom my worldly interests were dear. But nature then was sovereign in my heart, and mighty forms, seizing a youthful fancy, had given a charter to irregular hopes. In any age, without an impulse sent from work of nations and their goings on, I should have been possessed by like desire. But 'twas a time when Europe was rejoiced, France standing on the top of golden hours, and human nature seeming born again. Bound, as I said, to the Alps, it was our lot to land at Calais on the very eve of that great federal day. And there we saw, in a mean city and among a few, how bright a face is worn when joy of one is joy of tens of millions. Southward thence we took our way direct through hamlets, towns gaudy with relics of that festival, flowers left to wither on triumphal arcs and window garlands. On the public roads, and once 3 days successively, through paths by which our toilsome journey was abridged, among sequestered villages we walked, and found benevolence and blessedness spread like a fragrance everywhere, like spring that leaves no corner of the land untouched. A lonely pair of Englishmen we were, and sailed along, clustered together with a merry crowd of those emancipated, with a host of travellers, chiefly delegates, returning from the great spousals newly solemnized at their chief city in the sight of heaven. Like bees, they swarmed, gaudy and gay as bees. Some vapoured in the unruliness of joy and flourished with their swords as if to fight the saucy air. In this blithe company we landed, took with them our evening meal, guests welcome almost as the angels were to Abraham of old. The supper done, with flowing cups elate and happy thoughts, we rose at signal given and formed a ring, and hand in hand danced round and round the board. It is not my present purpose to retrace that variegated journey step by step. A march it was of military speed, and earth did change her images and forms before us fast as clouds are changed in heaven, day after day, up early and down late, from vale to vale, from hill to hill we went, from province unto province did we pass, keen hunters in a chase of 14 weeks, eager as birds of prey, or as a ship upon the stretch when winds are blowing fair. Sweet coverts did we cross of pastoral life, enticing valleys, greeted them and left too soon, while yet the very flash and gleam of salutation were not passed away. Oh, sorrow for the youth who could have seen unchastened, unsubdued, unawed, unraised to patriarchal dignity of mind and pure simplicity of wish and will, those sanctified abodes of peaceful man. My heart leaped up when first I did look down on that which was first seen of those deep haunts, a green recess, an aboriginal vale, quiet and lorded over and possessed by naked huts, wood-built and sown like tents or Indian cabins over the fresh lawns and by the riverside. That day we first beheld the summit of Mount Blanc and grieved to have a soulless image on the eye, which had usurped upon a living thought that never more could be. The wondrous vale of Chamonix did on the following dawn, with its dumb cataracts and streams of ice, a motionless array of mighty waves, 5 rivers broad and vast, make rich amends and reconciled us to realities. Upturning with a band of travellers from the Valais, we had clomb along the road that leads to Italy. A length of hours making of these our guides did we advance, and having reached an inn among the mountains, we together ate our noon's repast, from which the travellers rose, leaving us at the board. Ere long we followed, descending by the beaten road that led right to a rivulet's edge, and there broke off. The only track now visible was one upon the further side, right opposite, and up a lofty mountain. This we took, after a little scruple and short pause, and climbed with eagerness, though not at length without surprise and some anxiety, on finding that we did not overtake our comrades gone before. By fortunate chance, while every moment now increased our doubts, a peasant met us, and from him we learned that to the place which had perplexed us first we must descend, and there should find the road which in the stony channel of the stream lay a few steps, and then along its banks, and further that thenceforward all our course was downwards with the current of that stream. Hard of belief, we questioned him again, and all the answers which the man returned to our inquiries in their sense and substance, translated by the feelings which we had, ended in this, that we had crossed the Alps. Imagination, lifting up itself before the iron progress of my song like an unfathered vapour, here that power, in all the might of its endowments, came athwart me. I was lost as in a cloud, halted without a struggle to break through, and now recovering to my soul, I say, I recognize thy glory. In such strength of usurpation, in such visitings of awful promise, when the light of sense goes out, in flashes that have shown to us the invisible world, doth greatness make abode. There harbors, whether we be young or old, our destiny, our nature, and our home is with infinitude, and only there, with hope it is, hope that can never die, effort and expectation and desire and something ever more about to be. The mind beneath such banners militant thinks not of spoils or trophies, nor of aught that may attest its prowess, blessed in thoughts that are their own perfection and reward, strong in itself and in the access of joy which hides it like the overflowing Nile. The dull and heavy slackening which ensued upon those tidings by the peasant given was soon dislodged. Downwards we hurried fast, and entered with the road which we had missed into a narrow chasm. The brook and road were fellow travellers in this gloomy pass, and with them did we journey several hours at a slow step. The immeasurable height of woods decaying, never to be decayed, the stationary blasts of waterfalls, and everywhere along the hollow rent winds, thwarting winds, bewildered and forlorn, the torrents shooting from the clear blue sky, the rocks that muttered close upon our ears, black drizzling crags that spake by the wayside as if a voice were in them, the sick sight and giddy prospect of the raving stream, the unfettered clouds and region of the heavens, tumult and peace, the darkness and the light were all like workings of one mind. The features of the same face, blossoms upon one tree, characters of the great apocalypse, the types and symbols of eternity, of first and last and midst and without end. Through the whole summer have I been at rest, partly from voluntary holiday, and part through outward indolence. But I heard after the hour of sunset yestereven, sitting within doors betwixt light and dark, a voice that stirred me. 'Twas a little band, a choir of redbreasts, gathered somewhere near my threshold, minstrels from the distant woods and dells, sent in by winter to bespeak for the old man a welcome, to announce with preparation artful and benign, yea, the most gentle music of the year, that their rough lord had left the surly north and hath begun his journey. A delight at this unthought-of greeting, unawares, smote me, a sweetness of the coming time. And listening, I half-whispered, 'We will be, ye heartsome choristers, ye and I will be brethren, and in the hearing of bleak winds will chaunt together.' And thereafter, walking by later twilight on the hills, I saw a glow-worm from beneath a dusky shade, or canopy of yet unwithered fern, clear shining, like a hermit's taper seen through a thick forest. Silence touched me here no less than sound had done before. The child of summer, lingering, shining by itself, the voiceless worm on the unfrequented hills, seemed sent on the same errand with the choir of winter that had warbled at my door, and the whole year seemed tenderness and love. The last night's genial feeling overflowed upon this morning, and my favourite grove, now tossing its dark boughs in sun and wind, spreads through me a commotion like its own, something that fits me for the poet's task, which we will now resume with cheerful hope, nor checked by aught of tamer argument that lies before us, needful to be told. Returned from that excursion, soon I bade farewell forever to the private bowers of gowned students, quitted these no more to enter them, and pitched my vagrant tent, a casual dweller, and at large among the unfenced regions of society. Yet undetermined to what plan of life I should adhere, and seeming thence to have a little space of intermediate time loose and at full command, to London first I turned, if not in calmness, nevertheless in no disturbance of excessive hope, at ease from all ambition personal, frugal, as there was need, and though self-willed, yet temperate and reserved, and wholly free from dangerous passions. Marvellous things my fancy had shaped forth of sights and shows, processions, equipages, lords and dukes, the king and the king's palace, and not last or least, heaven bless him, the renowned Lord Mayor. Dreams hardly less intense than those which wrought a change of purpose in young Whittington, when he, in friendlessness, a drooping boy, sat on a stone and heard the bells speak out articulate music. Above all, one thought baffled my understanding. How men lived even next-door neighbours, as we say, yet still strangers, and knowing not each other's names. A wondrous power of words, how sweet they are according to the meaning which they bring. Vauxhall and Ranelagh. I then had heard of your green groves and wilderness of lamps, your gorgeous ladies, fairy cataracts and pageant fireworks. Nor must we forget those other wonders, different in kind, though scarcely less illustrious in degree, the river, proudly bridged, the giddy top and whispering gallery of St. Paul's, the tombs of Westminster, the giants of Guildhall, Bedlam, and the two figures at its gates, streets without end and churches numberless, statues with flowery gardens in vast squares, the monument and armory of the Tower. These fond imaginations of themselves had long before given way in season due, leaving a throng of others in their stead. And now I looked upon the real scene, familiarly perused it day by day with keen and lively pleasure. Even there where disappointment was the strongest, pleased through courteous self-submission, as a tax paid to the object by prescriptive right, a thing that ought to be. Shall I give way, copying the impression of the memory, though things remembered idly do half seem the work of fancy? Shall I, as the mood inclines me, here describe for pastime's sake some portion of that motley imagery, a vivid pleasure of my youth, and now, among the lonely places that I love, a frequent daydream for my riper mind? And first the look and aspect of the place, the broad highway appearance, as it strikes on strangers of all ages, the quick dance of colours, lights and forms, the Babel din, the endless stream of men and moving things. From hour to hour, the illimitable walk still among streets with clouds and sky above, the wealth, the bustle and the eagerness, the glittering chariots with their pampered steeds, stalls, barrows, porters midway in the street, the scavenger that begs with hat in hand, the labouring hackney coaches, the rash speed of coaches travelling far, whirled on with horn loud blowing, and the sturdy drayman's team, ascending from some alley of the Thames and striking right across the crowded strand, till the four-horse veer round with punctual skill. Here, there and everywhere, a weary throng, the comers and the goers face to face, face after face, the string of dazzling wares, shop after shop, with symbols, blazoned names, and all the tradesmen's honours overhead. At leisure thence, through tracts of thin resort and sights and sounds that come at intervals, we take our way. A raree show is here, with children gathered round. Another street presents a company of dancing dogs, or dromedary, with an antic pair of monkeys on his back, a minstrel band of Savoyards, or single and alone an English ballad singer. Private courts, gloomy as coffins, and unsightly lanes thrilled by some female vendor's scream belike the very shrillest of all London cries may then entangle us a while. Conducted through those labyrinths unawares to privileged regions and inviolate, where from their airy lodges studious lawyers look out on waters, walks and gardens green. O friend, one feeling was there which belonged to this great city by exclusive right. How often in the overflowing streets have I gone forwards with the crowd and said unto myself, the face of everyone that passes by me is a mystery. Thus have I looked, nor ceased to look, oppressed by thoughts of what and whither, when and how, until the shapes before my eyes became a second sight procession, such as glides over still mountains or appears in dreams, and all the ballast of familiar life, the present and the past, hope, fear, all stays, all laws of acting, thinking, speaking man, went from me, neither knowing me nor known. And once, far travelled in such mood, beyond the reach of common indications, lost amid the moving pageant, 'twas my chance abruptly to be smitten with the view of a blind beggar, who with upright face stood propped against a wall, upon his chest wearing a written paper to explain the story of the man and who he was. My mind did at this spectacle turn round, as with the might of waters, and it seemed to me that in this label was a type or emblem of the utmost that we know both of ourselves and of the universe, and on the shape of this unmoving man, his fixed face and sightless eyes, I looked as if admonished from another world. Though reared upon the base of outward things, these chiefly are such structures as the mind builds for itself. Scenes different there are, full-formed, which take with small internal help possession of the faculties. The peace of night, for instance, the solemnity of nature's intermediate hours of rest, when the great tide of human life stands still, the business of the day to come, unborn, of that gone by, locked up as in the grave, the calmness, beauty of the spectacle, sky, stillness, moonshine, empty streets and sounds unfrequent as in deserts. At late hours of winter evenings, when the unwholesome rains are falling hard, with people yet astir, the feeble salutation from the voice of some unhappy woman, now and then heard as we pass when no one looks about, nothing is listened to. But these, I fear, are falsely catalogued, things that are not, even as we give them welcome or assist, are prompt or are remiss. What say you then to times when half the city shall break out full of one passion, vengeance, rage, or fear, to executions, to a street on fire, mobs, riots, or rejoicings? From those sights, take one, an annual festival, the fair holden where martyrs suffered in past time and named of Saint Bartholomew. There see a work that's finished to our hands, that lays, if any spectacle on earth can do, the whole creative powers of man asleep. For once the Muses' help will we implore, and she shall lodge us, wafted on her wings, above the press and danger of the crowd, upon some showman's platform. What a hell for eyes and ears! What anarchy and din barbarian and infernal! It is a dream monstrous in colour, motion, shape, sight, sound. Below, the open space, through every nook of the wide area, twinkles, is alive with heads. The midway region and above is thronged with staring pictures and huge scrolls, dumb proclamations of the prodigies, and chattering monkeys dangling from their poles, and children whirling in their roundabouts. With those that stretch the neck and strain the eyes and crack the voice in rivalship, the crowd inviting, with buffoons against buffoons, grimacing, writhing, screaming, him who grinds the hurdy-gurdy, at the fiddle weaves, rattles the salt box, thumps the kettle drum, and him who at the trumpet puffs his cheeks, the silver-collared negro with his timbrel. Equestrians, tumblers, women, girls and boys, blue-breeched, pink-vested, and with towering plumes. All movables of wonder from all parts are here. Albinos, painted Indians, dwarfs, the horse of knowledge and the learned pig, the stone-eater, the man that swallows fire, giants, ventriloquists, the invisible girl, the bust that speaks and moves its goggling eyes, the waxwork, clockwork, all the marvellous craft of modern Merlins, wild beasts, puppet shows, all out the way, far-fetched, perverted things, all freaks of nature, all Promethean thoughts of man, his dullness, madness, and their feats all jumbled up together to make up this parliament of monsters. Tents and booths, meanwhile, as if the whole were one vast mill, are vomiting, receiving on all sides men, women, 3 years' children, babes in arms. Free as a colt at pasture on the hills, I ranged at large through the metropolis, month after month. Obscurely did I live, not courting the society of men by literature, or elegance, or rank distinguished. In the midst of things, it seemed, looking as from a distance on the world that moved about me. Yet insensibly false preconceptions were corrected thus, and errors of the fancy rectified, alike with reference to men,
and things, and sometimes from each quarter were poured in novel imaginations and profound. A year thus spent, this field, with small regrets save only for the bookstalls in the streets, wild produce, hedgerow fruit on all sides hung to lure the sauntering traveller from his track, I quitted and betook myself to France, led thither chiefly by a personal wish to speak the language more familiarly, with which intent I chose for my abode a city on the borders of the Loire. Through Paris lay my readiest path, and there I sojourned a few days, and visited in haste each spot of old and recent fame, the latter chiefly, from the Field of Mars down to the suburbs of St. Anthony, and from Montmartre southward to the Dome of Genevieve. In both her clamorous halls, the National Synod and the Jacobins, I saw the revolutionary power tossed like a ship at anchor, rocked by storms. The arcades I traversed in the Palace Huge of Orleans, coasted round and round the line of tavern, brothel, gaming house and shop, great rendezvous of worst and best, the walk of all who had a purpose or had not. I stared and listened with a stranger's ears to hawkers and haranguers, hubbub wild, and hissing factionists with ardent eyes, in knots or pairs or single, ant-like swarms of builders and subverters, every face that hope or apprehension could put on, joy, anger and vexation in the midst of gaiety and dissolute idleness. And when we chanced one day to meet a hunger-bitten girl who crept along, fitting her languid self unto a heifer's motion by a cord tied to her arm, and picking thus from the lane its sustenance, while the girl with her two hands was busy knitting in a heartless mood of solitude, and at the sight my friend in agitation said, 'Tis against that which we are fighting. I with him believed devoutly that a spirit was abroad which could not be withstood, that poverty, at least like this, would in a little time be found no more, that we should see the earth unthwarted in her wish to recompense the industrious and the lowly child of toil, all institutes forever blotted out that legalized exclusion, empty pomp abolished, sensual state and cruel power, whether by edict of the one or few, and finally, as sum and crown of all, should see the people having a strong hand in making their own laws, whence better days to all mankind. But these things set apart, was not the single confidence enough to animate the mind that ever turned a thought to human welfare? That henceforth captivity by mandate without law should cease, and open accusation lead to sentence in the hearing of the world, and open punishment, if not the air be free to breathe in, and the heart of man dread nothing. It was a beautiful and silent day that overspread the countenance of earth, then fading with unusual quietness, when from the Loire I parted, and through scenes of vineyard, orchard, meadow ground and tilth, calm waters, gleams of sun and breathless trees towards the fierce metropolis turned my steps their homeward way to England. From his throne the king had fallen. The congregated host, dire cloud, upon the front of which was written the tender mercies of the dismal wind that bore it, on the plains of liberty had burst innocuously. Say more, the swarm that came elate and jocund, like a band of eastern hunters to enfold in ring, narrowing itself by moments and reduced to the last punctual spot of their despair, a race of victims, so they deemed, themselves had shrunk from sight of their own task and fled in terror. Desolation and dismay remained for them whose fancies had grown rank with evil expectations, confidence and perfect triumph to the better cause. The state, as if to stamp the final seal on her security and to the world show what she was, a high and fearless soul, or rather in a spirit of thanks to those who had stirred up her slackening faculties to a new transition, had assumed with joy the body and the venerable name of a republic. Lamentable crimes, 'tis true, had gone before this hour, the work of massacre in which the senseless sword was prayed to as a judge. But these were past, earth free from them forever, as was thought. Ephemeral monsters to be seen but once, things that could only show themselves and die. This was the time in which, inflamed with hope, to Paris I returned. Again I ranged, more eagerly than I had done before, through the wide city, and in progress past the prison where the unhappy monarch lay, associate with his children and his wife, in bondage. And the palace lately stormed with roar of cannon and a numerous host. I crossed a blank and empty area then, the square of the carousel, a few weeks back, heaped up with dead and dying. Upon these and other sights, looking as doth a man upon a volume whose contents he knows are memorable, but from him locked up, being written in a tongue he cannot read, so that he questions the mute leaves with pain and half upbraids their silence. But that night, when on my bed I lay, I was most moved and felt most deeply in what world I was. My room was high and lonely, near the roof of a large mansion or hotel, a spot that would have pleased me in more quiet times, nor was it wholly without pleasure then. With unextinguished taper, I kept watch, reading at intervals. The fear gone by pressed on me almost like a fear to come. I thought of those September massacres, divided from me by a little month, and felt and touched them a substantial dread. The rest was conjured up from tragic fictions and mournful calendars of true history, remembrances and dim admonishments. The horse is taught his manage, and the wind of heaven wheels round and treads in his own steps. Year follows year. The tide returns again. Day follows day. All things have second birth. The earthquake is not satisfied at once. And in such way I wrought upon myself until I seemed to hear a voice that cried to the whole city, "Sleep no more." To this add comments of a calmer mind, from which I could not gather full security, but at the best it seemed a place of fear, unfit for the repose which night requires, defenseless as a wood where tigers roam. In this frame of mind, reluctantly to England I returned, compelled by nothing less than absolute want of funds for my support, else well assured that I both was and must be of small worth, no better than an alien in the land. I doubtless should have made a common cause with some who perished, haply perished too, a poor, mistaken, and bewildered offering. Should to the breast of nature have gone back with all my resolutions, all my hopes, a poet only to myself, to men useless, and even, beloved friend, a soul to thee unknown. Having gone abroad from a small village where I tarried then to the same far secluded privacy I was returning, over the smooth sands of Leven's ample estuary lay my journey, and beneath the genial sun, with distant prospect among gleams of sky and clouds and intermingled mountain tops, in one inseparable glory clad, creatures of one ethereal substance, met in consistory, like a diadem or crown of burning seraphs as they sit in Empyrean. Underneath this show lay, as I knew, the nest of pastoral vales among whose happy fields I had grown up from childhood. On the fulgent spectacle, which neither changed, nor stirred, nor passed away, I gazed, and with a fancy more alive on this account, that I had chanced to find that morning, ranging through the churchyard graves of Cartmel's rural town, the place in which an honoured teacher of my youth was laid. While we were schoolboys, he had died among us and was borne hither, as I knew, to rest with his own family. A plain stone inscribed with name, date, office, pointed out the spot, to which a slip of verses was subjoined by his desire, as afterwards I learned, a fragment from the Elegy of Gray. A week or little less before his death, he had said to me, "My head will soon lie low." And when I saw the turf that covered him, after the lapse of full 8 years, those words, with sound of voice and countenance of the man, came back upon me, so that some few tears fell from me in my own despite. And now, thus travelling smoothly o'er the level sands, I thought with pleasure of the verses graven upon his tombstone, saying to myself, he loved the poets, and if now alive, would have loved me, as one not destitute of promise, nor belying the kind hope which he had formed when I at his command began to spin at first my toilsome song. Without me, and within, as I advanced, all that I saw or felt or communed with was gentleness and peace. Upon a small and rocky island near, a fragment stood itself like a sea rock of what had been a Romish chapel, where in ancient times masses were said at the hour which suited those who crossed the sands with ebb of morning tide. Not far from this still ruin, all the plain was spotted with a variegated crowd of coaches, wains, and travellers, horse and foot wading beneath the conduct of their guide in loose procession through the shallow stream of inland water. The great sea, meanwhile, was at safe distance, far retired. I paused, unwilling to proceed, the scene appeared so gay and cheerful, when a traveller chancing to pass, I carelessly inquired if any news were stirring. He replied, in the familiar language of the day, that Robespierre was dead. Nor was a doubt on further question left within my mind, but that the tidings were substantial truth, that he and his supporters all were fallen. Great was my glee of spirit. Great my joy and vengeance, and eternal justice thus made manifest. "Come now, ye golden times," said I, forth breathing on those open sands a hymn of triumph. "As the morning comes out of the bosom of the night, come ye. Thus far our trust is verified. Behold they who with clumsy desperation brought rivers of blood and preached that nothing else could cleanse the Augean stable, by the might of their own helpers, have been swept away. Their madness is declared and visible. Elsewhere will safety now be sought, and earth march firmly towards righteousness and peace." Then schemes I framed more calmly, when and how the madding factions might be tranquilized, and though through hardships manifold and long, the mighty renovation would proceed. Thus interrupted by uneasy bursts of exultation, I pursued my way along that very shore which I had skimmed in former times, when spurring from the vale of nightshade and St. Mary's mouldering fane and the stone abbot, after circuit made in wantonness of heart, a joyous crew of schoolboys hastening to their distant home along the margin of the moonlight sea, we beat with thundering hoofs the level sand. From this time forth, in France, as is well known, authority put on a milder face. Yet everything was wanting that might give courage to those who looked for good by light of rational experience. Good, I mean, at hand and in the spirit of past aims. The same belief I nevertheless retained. The language of the Senate and the acts and public measures of the government, though both of heartless omen, had not power to daunt me. In the people was my trust, and in the virtues which mine eyes had seen, and to the ultimate repose of things I looked with unabated confidence. I knew that wound external could not take life from the young republic, that new foes would only follow in the path of shame their brethren, and her triumphs be in the end great, universal, irresistible. At a time when scarcely I was then not 6 years old, my hand could hold a bridle. With proud hopes, I mounted, and we rode towards the hills. We were a pair of horsemen. Honest James was with me, my encourager and guide. We have not travelled long, ere some mischance disjoined me from my comrade. And through fear, dismounting, down the rough and stony moor I led my horse, and stumbling on at length came to a bottom, where in former times a murderer had been hung in iron chains. The gibbet mast was moulded down, the bones and iron case were gone, but on the turf hard by, soon after that fell deed was wrought, some unknown hand had carved the murderer's name. The monumental writing was engraven in times long past, and still from year to year, by superstition of the neighbourhood, the grass was cleared away, and to this hour the letters are all fresh and visible. Faltering and ignorant where I was, at length I chanced to espy those characters inscribed on the green sod. Forthwith I left the spot, and reascending the bare common, saw a naked pool that lay beneath the hills, the beacon on the summit, and more near, a girl who bore a pitcher on her head, and seemed with difficult steps to force her way against the blowing wind. It was, in truth, an ordinary sight, but I should need colours and words that are unknown to man to paint the visionary dreariness, which, while I looked all round for my lost guide, did at that time invest the naked pool, the beacon on the lonely eminence, the woman and her garments vexed and tossed by the strong wind. When in a blessed season with those two dear ones to my heart so dear, when in the blessed time of early love, long afterwards, I roamed about in daily presence of this very scene, upon the naked pool and dreary crags, and on the melancholy beacon, fell the spirit of pleasure and youth's golden gleam. And think ye not, with radiance more divine from these remembrances and from the power they left behind? So feeling comes in aid of feeling, and diversity of strength attends us if but once we have been strong. O mystery of man, from what a depth proceed thy honours! I am lost, but see in simple childhood something of the base on which thy greatness stands. But this I feel, that from thyself it is that thou must give, else never canst receive. The days gone by come back upon me from the dawn almost of life. The hiding places of my power seem open, I approach, and then they close. I see by glimpses now. When age comes on, may scarcely see at all, and I would give, while yet we may, as far as words can give, a substance and a life to what I feel. I would enshrine the spirit of the past for future restoration. Yet another of these to me affecting incidents with which we will conclude. One Christmas time, the day before the holidays began, feverish and tired and restless, I went forth into the fields, impatient for the sight of those two horses which should bear us home, my brothers and myself. There was a crag, an eminence, which from the meeting point of two highways ascending, overlooked at least a long half-mile of those two roads, by each of which the expected steeds might come, the choice uncertain. Thither I repaired up to the highest summit. 'Twas a day stormy and rough and wild, and on the grass I sat half-sheltered by a naked wall. Upon my right hand was a single sheep, a whistling hawthorn on my left, and there, with those companions at my side, I watched, straining my eyes intensely as the mist gave intermitting prospect of the wood and plain beneath. Ere I to school returned that dreary time, ere I had been 10 days a dweller in my father's house, he died, and I and my two brothers, orphans then, followed his body to the grave. The event, with all the sorrow which it brought, appeared a chastisement. And when I called to mind that day so lately past, when from the crag I looked in such anxiety of hope, with trite reflections of morality, yet in the deepest passion, I bowed down to God who thus corrected my desires. And afterwards, the wind and sleety rain and all the business of the elements, the single sheep and the one blasted tree, and the bleak music of that old stone wall, the noise of wood and water, and the mist which on the line of each of those two roads advanced in such indisputable shapes, all these were spectacles and sounds to which I often would repair, and thence would drink as at a fountain. And I do not doubt that in this later time, when storm and rain beat on my roof at midnight, or by day when I am in the woods, unknown to me, the workings of my spirit thence are brought. In one of these excursions, travelling then through Wales, on foot, and with a youthful friend, I left Beth Kellett's huts at couching time, and westward took my way to see the sun rise from the top of Snowdon. Having reached the cottage at the mountain's foot, we there roused up the shepherd, who by ancient right of office is the stranger's usual guide, and after a short refreshment, sallied forth. It was a summer's night. A close, warm night, one, dull and glaring, with a dripping mist low hung and thick that covered all the sky, half-threatening storm and rain. But on we went unchecked, being full of heart and having faith in our tried pilot. Little could we see, hemmed round on every side with fog and damp, and after ordinary travellers' chat with our conductor, silently we sunk each into commerce with his private thoughts. Thus did we breast the ascent, and by myself was nothing either seen or heard the while which took me from my musings, save that once the shepherd's cur did to his own great joy unearth a hedgehog in the mountain crags, round which he made a barking turbulent. This small adventure, for even such it seemed in that wild place, and at the dead of night, being over and forgotten, on we wound in silence as before. With forehead bent earthward as if in opposition set against an enemy, I panted up with eager pace and no less eager thoughts. Thus might we wear perhaps an hour away, ascending at loose distance each from each, and I, as chanced, the foremost of the band, when at my feet the ground appeared to brighten, and with a step or two seemed brighter still. Nor had I time to ask the cause of this, for instantly a light upon the turf fell like a flash. I looked about, and lo, the moon stood naked in the heavens, at height immense above my head, and on the shore I found myself of a huge sea of mist, which meek and silent rested at my feet. 100 hills their dusky backs upheaved all over this still ocean, and beyond, far, far beyond, the vapours shot themselves in headlands, tongues and promontory shapes into the sea, the real sea that seemed to dwindle and give up its majesty, usurped upon as far as sight could reach. Meanwhile the moon looked down upon this show in single glory, and we stood, the mist touching our very feet. And from the shore, at distance not the third part of a mile, was a blue chasm, a fracture in the vapour, a deep and gloomy breathing place through which mounted the roar of waters, torrents, streams innumerable, roaring with one voice. The universal spectacle throughout was shaped for admiration and delight, grand in itself alone, but in that breach through which the homeless voice of waters rose, that dark, deep thoroughfare had nature lodged the soul, the imagination of the whole. And now, O friend, this history is brought to its appointed close. The discipline and consummation of the poet's mind in everything that stood most prominent hath faithfully been pictured. We have reached the time which was our object from the first, when we may, not presumptuously, I hope, suppose my powers so far confirmed, and such my knowledge as to make me capable of building up a work that should endure. Yet much hath been omitted, as need was, of books, how much, and even of the other wealth which is collected among woods and fields, far more. For nature's secondary grace, that outward illustration which is hers, hath hitherto been barely touched upon. The charm more superficial and yet sweet which from her works finds way, contemplated as they hold forth a genuine counterpart and softening mirror of the moral world. Let one word more of personal circumstance, not needless as it seems, be added here. Since I withdrew unwillingly from France, my story hath demanded less regard to time and place, and where I lived and how hath been no longer scrupulously marked. 3 years until a permanent abode received me with that sister of my heart who ought by rights the dearest to have been conspicuous through this biographic verse, star seldom utterly concealed from view. I led an undomestic, wanderer's life. In London chiefly was my home, and thence excursively as personal friendships, chance or inclination led, or slender means gave leave, I roamed about from place to place, tarrying in pleasant nooks wherever found through England or through Wales. Having now told what best merits mention, further pains our present labour seems not to require, and I have other tasks. Call back to mind the mood in which this poem was begun, O friend. The termination of my course is nearer now, much nearer, yet even then, in that distraction and intense desire, I said unto the life which I had lived, Where art thou? Hear I not a voice from thee, which 'tis reproach to hear. Anon I rose as if on wings, and saw beneath me stretched vast prospect of the world which I had been and was. And hence this song, which like a lark I have protracted in the unwearied heaven singing, and often with more plaintive voice a temper to the sorrows of the earth, yet centering all in love, and in the end all gratulant, if rightly understood. Whether to me shall be allotted life, and with life power, to accomplish aught of worth sufficient to excuse me in men's sight for having given this record of myself, is all uncertain. But, beloved friend, when looking back, thou seest in clearer view than any sweetest sight of yesterday that summer when on Quantock's grassy hills far-ranging, and among the sylvan coombs, thou in delicious words, with happy heart, did speak the vision of that ancient man, the bright-eyed mariner, and rueful woes didst utter of the Lady Christabel, and I, associate in such labour, walked, murmuring of him who, joyous hap, was found after the perils of his moonlight ride near the loud waterfall, or her who sat in misery near the miserable thorn. When thou dost to that summer turn thy thoughts, and hast before thee all which then we were, to thee, in memory of that happiness, it will be known, by thee at least, my friend, felt, that the history of a poet's mind is labour not unworthy of regard. To thee the work shall justify itself. The last and later portions of this gift, which I for thee design, have been prepared in times which have, from those wherein we first together wandered in wild poesy, differed thus far that they have been, my friend, times of much sorrow, of a private grief keen and enduring, which the frame of mind that in this meditative history hath been described more deeply makes me feel, yet likewise hath enabled me to bear more firmly, and a comfort now, a hope, one of the dearest which this life can give, is mine, that thou art near and wilt be soon restored to us in renovated health. Then, after the first mingling of our tears, among other consolations, we may find some pleasure from this offering of my love. Oh, yet a few short years of useful life, and all will be complete, thy race be run, thy monument of glory will be raised. Then, though too weak to tread the ways of truth, this age fall back to old idolatry, though men return to servitude as fast as the tide ebbs, to ignominy and shame by nations sink together, we shall still find solace in the knowledge which we have. Blessed with true happiness, if we may be united helpers forward of a day of firmer trust, joint laborers in a work, should Providence such grace to us vouchsafe, of their redemption, surely yet to come. Prophets of nature, we to them will speak a lasting inspiration, sanctified by reason and by truth. What we have loved, others will love. And we may teach them how, instruct them how the mind of man becomes a thousand times more beautiful than the earth on which he dwells, above this frame of things, which mid all revolutions and the hopes and fears of men doth still remain unchanged, in beauty exalted, as it is itself of substance and of fabric more divine.
Sir Ian McKellen was reading from The Prelude by William Wordsworth. The music was composed by John Hall and performed by John Hall on soprano saxophone and Neil McColl on guitar. The Prelude was produced in Manchester by Susan Roberts with sound design by Steve Brook.
We live in different worlds, and the only thing we have to do to keep it that way is make sure the lines between us never, ever cross.
So, motive? Revenge.
You kill a cop, you'll never see daylight.
Where'd you get that from? A 5-day course in Hendon?
You think I can do this?
Oh, I don't think, Gabriel. I know.
If you miss The Shadow Line, watch the series so far on BBC iPlayer. Go to bbc.co.uk/iPlayer.